This is the Alka story. For months preceding January 1956, five missionary men, Nate Saint, Ed McCulley, Roger Udarian, Pete Fleming, and Jim Elliott, made preparations to make a friendly contact with the unreached Ecuadorian tribe of Indians, the Aucas. Ed and Nate discovered the tribe's location in September 1955. Then they began a system of gift drops. The plan involved C-Day, or Contact Day, which was to be January 3rd. On that date, 1956, the first flight was made to the sandbar along the Kururai River. There, Nate Saint maneuvered his plane to a perfect landing. Ed McCulley was left to guard while Nate went and got the others. By the second day, January 4th, they had their treehouse built and were calling out Alka phrases to the trees surrounding them. Now, it is the third day at Palm Beach. We take up the Alka story with Robert Savage narrating.
The third day, Thursday, January 5th, 1956, all was quiet on Palm Beach, but they all felt sure that they were being watched by Alkas. While the five waited, took pictures, studied the Alka language, went swimming and fishing, slept and read. They described their location as a paradise except for the 47 billion flying insects. That night, one of them wrote, "We find we have a friendlier feeling for these fellows all the time. But we must not let this lead us to carelessness. It is no small thing to try to bridge between 20th century and the Stone Age." Meanwhile, the wives were back home. Betty Elliott, with little Valerie, was in Shandia, about 25 flying minutes away from the scene. Barbara Udarian, with Beth and Jerry, were with Mary Lou McCulley and her two boys, Steve and Mike, in Arahuno. Olive Fleming was in Shalmeta with Marge Saint and her three children, Steve, Kathy, and baby Philip. We can't help but wonder how the women felt during those days. Mary Lou McCulley tells us.
"It's hard to remember thinking back so far, but I think the feeling that stands out the most in my mind those particular days when the fellows first went was one of excitement, one of confidence. Knowing that God had led, my confidence was that nothing could go wrong. And in those days, that meant to me that the fellows would be safe. Since then, I've learned to trust the Lord, not that everything will go in my estimation right, but to trust the Lord no matter what does happen, knowing that his ways are higher than my ways, his thoughts are higher than my thoughts."
And Marge Saint describes her impressions.
"Those were busy days. I remember that I didn't dare leave the communications set, even when the fellows said that they wouldn't be calling in for perhaps 2 or 3 hours. But I was always there, just hoping that perhaps that something would happen. Perhaps the Alkas would come and they would call us, and what if I didn't have the radio turned on? Each night at Bible story time, I would tell the children what I had heard from their daddy that day. All those days, I remember being happy. Happy to know that the Lord's time had come to contact the Alkas, and happy to know that he was giving these five fellows a part in it."
Friday morning, January 6th, 1956, the five men were again on the beach. Pete and Nate had just flown in to join the three who were living in the treehouse. About 11:15 a.m., their hearts jumped when a clear, masculine voice boomed out from across the river. For the first time in missionary history, missionaries were face to face with the dreaded Alkas. Three Alkas stepped into the open, a young man and two women. They wore no clothing except G-strings tied around their waists. The missionaries, for the moment, were struck dumb by the surprise appearance, but finally managed to shout in Alka, "Puinani," meaning welcome. Jim Elliott waded into the water to meet them. With many references to their phrase books, the five conveyed that their visitors need not be afraid. Raj brought out some paring knives, which they accepted with cries of delight. Nate presented them with a machete and a model aeroplane. Then all the fellas dug out their cameras and took dozens of photos while the women looked through a copy of Time magazine. And the man was doused with insecticide to demonstrate civilization's way of dealing with swarming pests. The group spontaneously began referring to the man as George and the younger woman as Delilah. The missionaries demonstrated for their Stone Age guests such modern marvels as rubber bands, balloons, and a yo-yo. They served them lemonade and hamburgers with mustard, and even took George for a ride in the aeroplane. When he was back again on the beach, he leaped out of the plane, clapping his hands. The five men immediately gave thanks to God, with heads up to try to show their visitors that they were addressing their Father in Heaven. When the Alcas indicated that they might spend the night on the beach, the men offered them the small shack they had been using for cooking. Delilah, however, had other ideas. She wheeled and walked off down the beach. George called to her, but she kept going. Then he followed her into the forest. The older woman stayed on the beach most of the night. The next morning, when Jim came down to start the fire, he found her gone, but the embers from her fire were still glowing. The events of the next day, Saturday, January 7th, were anticlimactic. The men waited hopefully, expecting the Alcas to arrive momentarily with an invitation to go to their village. But no one came. Tossing in his bunk that night, Nate wondered if everything possible had been done to interest the visitors and encourage them to return with their friends. Why had they been so casual? They seemed almost bored at times as he looked back on it. Jim's explanation had, however, reassured him that that's the way it is with the Indian. And if you landed him on the moon, he'd be satisfied in 5 minutes. Sunday morning, January 8th, 1956. Pete and Nate in Arahuno climbed into the plane to fly to the beach where they would join the others. As they left, Pete called, "So long, girls. Pray. I believe today is the day." At Palm Beach, the fellows enjoyed the ice cream and warm muffins which Mary Lou had sent along. Then they agreed that Nate should fly over the Alka village again. As he circled over Terminal City, he found only a handful of women and children. But this sent his spirit soaring, because undoubtedly the men were at last on their way to the Curaray. And sure enough, on the flight back, he spotted a group of men en route to Palm Beach. As he touched down his wheels, he shouted to the four, "This is it, fellas. They're on the way."
This is Nate Saint of the Missionary Aviation Fellowship.
A contact with us in Chalmetta had been arranged for 12:30. Breathlessly and still using their code words, Nate told of spotting a commission of 10 on the way from Terminal City, adding, "It looks like they'll be here for the early afternoon service. Pray for us. This is the day. We'll contact you next at 4:30. And then the radio contact was over.
At 4:30 sharp, Marge eagerly switched on the radio receiver in Chalmetta. This was the moment when the big news would come. She looked at her watch again.
Yes, it was time to tune for their voices. I listened. The interference was bad, but it would clear up, I thought. Ruth Keenan turned on the receiver in her house. She called to me after a few minutes to ask if I had heard anything. Thinking maybe I was off frequency, I tuned the set. But not a thing but noise came over the speaker. And then I called into the microphone, "Chalmetta calling and tuning for Palm Beach. Please give us a long call so that we can tune you in." But no amount of tuning or calling brought us any word.
It was 4:30 p.m., Sunday, January 8th, but no sound from Palm Beach. Marge and Olive in Chalmetta listened intently. Mary Lou and Barbara in Arahuno had to turn their radio on, but not a crackle broke the silence. Perhaps the men were so preoccupied with entertaining their visitors that they had forgotten the planned contact. Or perhaps Nate's watch had run a little slow. Or perhaps the radio was not functioning properly. The women clung to each little hope, refusing to entertain the thought that anything might have gone wrong. Listen to a recording Marge Saint made soon after that.
Then came Sunday night, after the fellows had been down on the beach. We hoped to hear from them at 4:35, but no word came. It was the first night that I had ever gone to bed since we came to Ecuador in 1948, that I did not know where Nate was in that little yellow airplane. It was the very first night.
By 7 o'clock the next morning, Monday, January 9th, Johnny Keenan, Nate's colleague pilot, was in the air flying toward the sand strip which Nate had earlier pointed out to him. About 9:30 that morning, Johnny's report came through, and Marge relayed it to Betty Elliott, who was in Shandia. It was the first Betty had known of the concern. This was the report.
Johnny has found the plane on the beach, Betty. All the fabric is stripped off. There is no sign of the fellows.
Marge Saint recalled soon after how that God had placed certain people in the out-of-the-way village of Shalmeta at just the right time. This is another recording taken back in 1956.
And again, we fell back to that verse, that all things work together for good. Larry Montgomery, of the Wycliffe Bible Translators, should not have been in Chalmette at that time, but God had him there. And Larry is a reserve officer in the Air Force. He was on his way to Panama. That morning, as he came into the office room where we have the radio, he sensed that something was wrong. And Larry immediately sent a cablegram to Panama. The Army, the Navy, and the Air Force came.
Larry Montgomery lost no time in contacting Lieutenant General William K. Harrison, Commander-in-Chief of the Caribbean Command. Radio station HCJB was notified. HCJB is a missionary radio station in Quito, Ecuador, just a day's journey away from Chalmeta. Just the month previously, HCJB had dedicated a new 50,000-watt radio transmitter and, with the added power, flashed the news around the world. Five men missing in Alca territory.
Yesterday, the voice of the Andes was notified via shortwave messages through the Ecuador Jungle Radio Network that five missionaries who were making a survey in dangerous Indian territory had been out of radio contact with their base for over 24 hours. It was reported that the Missionary Aviation Fellowship plane that flew them in had been spotted from the air on a river bank or the beach of a small island in the river.
By noon, all possible forces which might contribute to their rescue, including the prayers of thousands of people in all parts of the world, were set in motion. On Tuesday morning, January 10th, word was received that a helicopter was on its way from Panama. Missionary men came from Quito and various jungle stations to form a ground party to go to the beach overland in search of the five men.
On Wednesday, January 11th, Johnny Keenan flew over the spot again and spotted the form of one of the five missionary men. During that same day, some of the ground party men were flown into our station at Arahuno.
And late that afternoon, the roar of planes was heard. As they drew near and circled the airfield in Chalmeta, the red, white, and blue of the United States Air Force became visible. Still later that afternoon, we got word that Johnny Keenan had sighted yet another of our husbands.
Wednesday, Ruth Keenan came on the jungle radio with this announcement.
This is Ruth speaking, Paul. Johnny just called in. I'll put on the gas. Another body, over.
Please repeat. Please repeat. Over.
Johnny called in and said that they had seen another body. Over.
Okay. We're deeply sorry, and we'll be standing with you in prayer. Over.
Okay, Paul.
None of us wives knew which two these might prove to be, but we did know in whom we had believed. His grace was sufficient.
Here is a plane-to-ground communication from the U.S. C-47 to Marge Saint in Shalmera.
Roger, Shalmera, 7195. We departed the incident site about 5 minutes ago. We're going to look at the Vallano River at this time.
Abe Vanderpoy reports direct from Shalmera.
Five ladies here at Shalmera, and praise God for the wonderful testimony that they are giving in the midst of sorrow and heartache.
As you know, weather was very difficult early in the morning, and finally, after weather permitted, at about 1:45 p.m., three planes took off for Arajuno, a C-47 of the United States Navy, an H-13 helicopter of the United States Army, and the Piper Pacer of the Missionary Aviation Fellowship. The landing was made at 2:30 p.m. at which time the helicopter was refueled.
Meanwhile, the world was being notified by shortwave radio. Here is the message Dr. Clarence Jones presented through the facilities of radio station HCJB on Thursday, January 12th, 1956.
This is the latest information on the situation of the missing missionaries in the jungle of Ecuador. The air search party that went to the site of the accident this afternoon, including the helicopter crew with the pilot, Captain McGee, and with Major Nurnberg, landed at the site. Major Nurnberg had the opportunity of being on the beach by the damaged plane.
About 4 o'clock that afternoon, while the ground party was starting toward the scene, aeroplanes from the United States Army, Navy, and Air Force, and the Ecuadorian Air Force, all circled to keep pace with the slower helicopter skimming along at treetop level. Finally, the helicopter rounded the last bend and landed on Palm Beach. Air Force Major Nuremberg jumped out and looked around. Anxious minutes went by. Back in the helicopter, he radioed, "No one here." The helicopter took off again and started slowly down the river. 4 times it stopped to hover. Hearts sank in the aircraft above as they guessed the meaning of those stops of the helicopter. Frank Drown headed up the ground party, and here he is to describe what was happening to the party of 30 heading toward Palm Beach.
We spent the afternoon and the evening hours preparing for our trip. We bought a few staple supplies in Shalmera that night and slept very little as we're thinking about the trip ahead of us. Early the next morning, we were to be on the airfield at 6 o'clock in the morning to be flown in by Tau Air Company. And we met on the airstrip about 6.
Right, and the land party has to leave this morning in order to be out there by the time the helicopter gets there, over. And if those planes don't get in, so well, then the land party will already be gone because Tau's taking out all their supplies and the rest of the fellows now.
But I was left behind because the men from the Air Force were showing me how to operate the little radio that I was to carry along with me. So I was flown then in the little mission airplane out to Arajuno. I could see the soldiers, the missionaries, and the Indians gathering together down at the airfield as we approached the strip. And we landed, found out that preparations were already underway. The soldiers, Ecuadorian soldiers, were there, ready to go. And Dee Short and Maury Fuller were getting the Indians together. And so we started down the strip, wandered out down the end of the strip out through the brush, the overgrown part of the airfield, and then on an old overgrown road down to along the river, and made our way on toward the Oglan River. We arrived at Oglan at 5 that night. And of course, we were a little bit, or considerably jittery, and watched all the things that moved along the trail. And just as we were there starting down this incline to the Oglan, we heard the little airplane fly over. We got up real early and found out that one of the machine guns didn't have its safety on all night long. We don't know who tripped it off, and if anybody would have bumped it or even hit it, it would have gone off. We're all situated in our canoes and prayed, as asked the Lord to help us in our trip and to watch over us. And we prayed for the fellows that if any would be alive, that we could get to them and help them. And so we started downstream. The first part of the stream was a little tough going because the river was very low and lots of rocks. And it was difficult until we got to where the Oglan joined the Kuradai. And even there, for the first hour or two, it wasn't very good going. But after that, we got out into deeper water and where the land levels out some. And it was comparatively nice traveling. We were very careful to keep to the center of the stream whenever possible, and whenever the current or the river itself went toward the bank at the side, we would watch with our guns poised and ready, not to kill the Indians, but to have them see that we were alerted, and that so that they would be afraid and would not attack us. We expected the plane early, and it finally came, and said that he was on his way downstream to look at the site once more, and then he'd be back and give us a report. It was just a few minutes, however, until they came back and said that there was two canoe loads of Quechua Indians who had been at the site and were now returning, were just downstream a couple of kilometers, that we'd soon meet them, and surely they'd have some news for us. So we paddled hard, and finally one of the Indians yelled and says, "There they come." So downstream, we could see the Indians coming. And they rowed as fast as they could. It was raining. They paddled as fast as they could, and we paddled as fast as we could until we met. We didn't pull over to the side and park the canoes, pull them on the beach, but stopped right in the middle of the river, jumped out and grabbed the canoes and began to converse. Of course, I was rather impatient. I couldn't understand Quechua and had to wait until it was interpreted. And then we found out that they said that they had been at Palm Beach. They had seen the airplane, and that they had found one of the fellows. And of course, I asked right away, who was he? And they said, "We know who he was. It's Ed McCulley. He's right from where we live."
These Quechuas had boldly pressed into the Alka territory ahead of anyone else and had gone all the way to Palm Beach. One of them, a believer who had come to know Christ since we had been in Artahuno, told the ground party that he had found my husband on the beach at the edge of the water, and he brought me Ed's watch.
We interrupt Frank Drown's account of the ground party to listen to Abe Vanderpoy's reporting of the same incident over the jungle network.
This afternoon, it was found out from the land party that the Indians who were sighted yesterday in two canoes, about eight Indians, had made contact with the land party. These Indians had gone down as far as the site of the accident, and while being there just a short time, went up into the treehouse and looked around. There they found a radio, which they took out with them and turned over to Frank Brown when they met the land party.
So I wanted to get some more with the party, and also I wanted some of these Indians who had seen the beach as it was to go back with us so they could check the beach again to see if the Aucas were in the area. Because if there were any changes made there, they would notice it, which we would not know. We slept along the river a little below El Capricho, and made our shelters, put a pile of canoes up for a fort, and slept comparatively well, taking turns, two at a time, watching each side of camp. Got up early the next morning, again asked the Lord to care for us. This time we arrived at a spot close to Alka country now, and by this time the helicopter had come. We started on Wednesday, and this was on Thursday that we made contact with the helicopter. We were a little bit more nervous that night as we slept, and had to watch real carefully, and took turns, of course, guarding, and it was a little more difficult.
While the ground party prepared to sleep, Abe Vandepoy at Shalmera was sending a message by Jungle Radio Network to Quito.
It's amazing to see the wonderful sustaining grace that God has given to the wives of these five men. It's a revelation and a demonstration of the power of the gospel and the consolation that the Holy Spirit and our wonderful God can give.
Okay, Abe, okay. Thank you so much for your report. We are all deeply grieved and shocked here, as I'm sure you know, not only on our behalf personally, but on behalf of the entire missionary colony here in Quito. MD Quito over to Shalmeta.
While the world was waiting and wondering, Marge Saint continued at the communications set in Shalmeta.
They say they have a doubt if it would be flying this afternoon. This morning they did see two bodies. And then up above the playa, they saw large footprints on the sand that looked as if they came out and back into the jungle, they say. And that's all we know, over.
Okay, Mary Lou, how are you feeling? How are you feeling personally, over?
Oh, I'm feeling fine, Marge. I'm feeling fine. Thanks, over.
Be sure to let us know anything that you need, over.
Okay, Marge. Okay, I will. Everything is fine here, and we'll be standing by and hoping for work today, over.
Okay.
Here is Frank Drown to continue his narrative of the next day, the ground party on Friday.
Then, got up early, started on the last day. And naturally, we're a little more tense now as we go along the river. We're closer to Alca country. We're watching a little closer. Every leaf that moved, we were watching it. Our eyes were wide open. We were getting close, and we thought, well, now we must be about there. And then we found a tree that had been chopped over by an axe. We could see it had been cut with an axe. And we surely figured, well, now this must be the place where the men cut down so the airplane could have a better approach. And sure enough, just around the next corner, the Indian yelled out the word, airplane, airplane. And certainly, I don't know about the rest, but my heart was really heavy. And I said, Lord, give me grace and strength.